From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. There is no longer a statue of Christopher Columbus outside the Minnesota State House in St. Paul, Twin City to Minneapolis. The toppling, or reckoning, was led by members of the American Indian Movement and others who have for years tried to have the statue removed through official channels. Another Columbus statue was decapitated in Boston this week, and another was pulled down in Richmond, Virginia, along with a statue of Jefferson Davis, the first and only president of the Confederate States of America.
And I want to show you what it looks like here now, because you can still see the pedestal on the ground right here covered in spray paint. And right behind that is actually a crack in the sidewalk where that pedestal hit the ground.
The statue of the former Confederate president was put up in June of 1907, and now 113 years later, it has been pulled down.
The architects and enforcers of slavery have been literally deplatformed. And likewise, the most omnipresent symbol of race supremacy, the Confederate battle flag. It was not entirely surprising that in these days the Marine Corps finally prohibited its display on public workspaces, including mugs, bumper stickers, and cars. But this other one, this one here, was kind of breathtaking.
NASCAR has announced that it is banning the flying of Confederate flags at its races and other events, saying in a statement, the presence of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events runs contrary to their commitment to a welcoming, inclusive environment for fans.
NASCAR, born of bootleggers and good old boys and Southern culture, has at long last repudiated the most ubiquitous totem of racist defiance. Even if this was a woefully tardy surrender to pressure, this formal end to a long-standing practice is the dictionary definition of abolishing, which is so the word of the week. With deep roots in the mid-19th century, until recently, abolitionism has been seen as an artifact of our distant, sordid history. But amid civic outrage about racist policing, it has come roaring back. With various reform exercises over decades proven impotent against deep-seated police racism, activists are seeking, in various degrees, the wholesale dismantling of municipal police.
The organization is calling for defunding the NYPD budget of $5.5 billion, using that money to invest in black and brown communities.
There is a protest headed to Mayor Libby Schaaf's house here in Oakland, asking her to defund the city's police department.
I spoke to the president of the city council, who says they want to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department and replace it with a new public safety model.
The idea is so radical that some politicians immediately sought to water it down, reinterpreting abolition as just another go at reform.
They're saying we want fundamental, basic change when it comes to policing. Our state legislative packages will do that. So I think you will see a shift all across police departments.
But no, its proponents mean business, and the business did not just open up in the past 3 weeks. To understand how we got to this particular demand, we have to go back to September 1998, when 3,500 anti-prison academics and activists met for critical resistance beyond the prison industrial complex, a conference held to strategize and reignite a long-simmering movement to abolish prison and the police.
We want to talk this weekend about radical strategies that help to alleviate the misery and the pain.
Angela Davis, one of the leading figures in the movement at that conference.
And at the same time, move toward the abolition of prisons as the only attempt to solve the major social problems of our time.
Critical resistance articulates a critique of what they call the prison industrial complex.
Amna Akbar is a law professor at The Ohio State University and writes on today's leftist social movements and their demands. She explains that in 2014, following the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in Staten Island, some of these abolitionists began to engage with the Black Lives Matter movement, which was composed of a mix of veteran organizers and new activists taking to the streets for the first time. Working together, they reached a point just before Donald Trump was elected when the abolitionist demands were codified.
Right. August 2016, the Movement for Black Lives, which is a constellation of 50-plus Black-led organizations, releases a massive policy platform called the Vision for Black Lives. And the Vision for Black Lives has six kind of large demands, which include end the war on Black people, invest, divest, economic justice, reparations, and a few others. And the Vision for Black Lives marks kind of the drift between 2014 and 2016 and the influence of abolitionist politics on racial justice organizing. Because while the vision doesn't call for outright abolition of prisons and police, the vast majority of the demands reflect an abolitionist ethos. So for example, the meta demand, end the war on Black people, includes a list of campaigns or demands like ending solitary confinement, ending immigrant detention, ending cash bail, ending the school-to-prison pipeline. And if you're ensconced in the world of criminal law reform, you would have immediately noticed that these demands were in a very different register than a lot of the demands that come out of mainstream kind of DC-centric liberal policy reform, which are often focused on questions of how to make these systems work better. And so the vision is released in 2016 in August. Trump is elected in November. His election marks a federal government hostile to racial justice. The push that the Vision for Black Lives is laying out goes local.
And all of this activity is taking place long before the world ever hears of George Floyd.
That's right.
Now, we think of Minneapolis as the turning point, but there was actually another inflection point a few months previous, triggered not by police brutality, but by the coronavirus.
Right. COVID-19, we start to feel the pain of the lack of social services and the lack of the social welfare net. And so you have the explosion of these demands all over the country around canceling rent, around Medicare for all, around free them all. Campaigns around the country focused on putting pressure on local and state government and on the federal government to release people held in jails, prisons, and detention centers because of the way that incarcerated people are not able to socially distance. There's no adequate health provision within these facilities. If you read between the lines, a lot of those campaigns were actually articulating a critique of prisons and jails that was much deeper, an abolitionist critique about how prisons and jails are fundamentally unhealthy. And then when George Floyd is killed and the police respond in the way that they do to the organic uprisings all around the country, countless numbers of police outfitted in all sorts of expensive vehicles and vests and wood pellets and sound devices, I think it creates another kind of visible moment of the contradictions of life in the United States. We are repeatedly telling the public that we don't have enough money for books in the schools. Our healthcare workers don't have access to masks, PPE. And at the same time, you have the police forces mobilized like that to crush an organic uprising responding to the scale and depth of police violence around the country.
So here we are at Defund the Police. I will confess that when I first heard those words, which, by the way, was only a week ago, I was like, wait, what? How abolishy are we talking about?
I think for some people, defund is simply about taking money away from the police and maybe investing it in other places. But for racial justice movements and racial justice organizations, defund marks a moment where large swaths of the American public are, one, grappling with the problem being the institution of the police, right? So it's not simply about an individual bad police officer or an individual incident gone wrong, but the problem is the scale of the police, the power of the police, the tools of the police to use violence against everyday people. For abolitionists, defund is a strategy to delegitimize the police, force a question about what work police are doing in our communities and how else we might be dealing with social problems like homelessness or domestic violence or theft. Now, a lot of times I think abolitionists are charged as being unsophisticated and impractical. And I think the defund demand and the campaigns against jail expansion or the bailouts and the bail funds all demonstrate direct and concrete ways of thinking about building towards a world where we have no police or prisons, or at least a lot less of it. There's no delusion that we're going to live in a world where people don't harm each other or that no one steals from your house anymore. Part of what it is to live in a society is to have conflict. And right now, our go-to response to all of those things is prisons and police. And the abolitionist invitation is to say, what if we start to think about different ways to respond to those same problems?
I am obliged to ask you about politics. The choice of the words abolition and defund the police, while being very powerful for rallying support, are also sort of a gift to reactionary criticism. And the allegations, which have for decades been made, that the left is out to destroy the society. Does the language of defund create a opportunity for a political opposition that could crush the movement aborting?
So we have a moment right now where there's a growing left who are trying to disrupt consensus over a number of different issues and trying to disrupt politics as usual. And so whether you're talking about the Sunrise Movement and the Green New Deal or the Democratic Socialists of America calling for us to cancel rent around the country, all of these different campaigns are coming out of a moment where the failures of neoliberalism, the exploitation and stratification of capitalism, the violence of white supremacy have been made clear. And all of these different organizations, these movements, the aligned elected officials are all calling for a radical rupture with the way that we think about how we should relate to each other, what we expect of the state. What are our basic entitlements as human beings? And so while there might be a right-wing backlash, we are living through an era of a right-wing backlash, we can't be so fearful of a backlash that we can't imagine together and fight together and build together the world that we want to live in. And so I think this idea that we shouldn't fight big, dream big, organize together, is in part to blame for where we are.
Understood. Do you worry that the political right is now going to be able to terrify swing voters into not risking throwing in with the left less pandemonium reign?
Part of what I'm seeing and what I'm so kind of excited and hopeful about, even though I also feel cautious and I feel a lot of the trepidation that you're articulating, is that it feels as if we're in a moment that could unleash a much more hopeful politics in the United States and a much more hopeful, inclusive vision that will shift people's kind of expectations or sense of what's possible. And as much as who is at the top of the food chain, the president of the United States, matters for who the United States is, how we respond to crises like COVID-19, what kind of player we are in the world, politics is local. And there are all sorts of other decisions at every level of interpersonal relations, city and state government, that also make a profound difference for the daily condition of everyday people's lives. Part of what's really important about what's going on right now is that it is exploding the concept that politics is only about voting for the president of the United States. Politics is about a lot more than that, including protests and uprising, including casting a ballot, including leading into local political struggles over whether to defund the police.
Amna, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Amna Akbar is a professor of law at The Ohio State University. Coming up, when cops lie, this is on the media.